Okay, for the sake of the recording, which I understand is running, this is the session at 11 o'clock, Secrets of Mary Magdalene. It was intended to be presented by Maxine Hanks, who was stranded on the East Coast for travel reasons and was unable to make it, but we had the benefit of the DVD of a roundtable discussion that took place. I'm not sure where, but effectively we'll show that, and then Todd Compton has graciously agreed to lead a discussion after the video.
That becomes an important way of establishing a kind of tradition or succession. then what does that say about the disappearance of magical traditions? But we have to remember that even as Gospels like Matthew have become canonical in the 4th century, that non-canonical texts like this disappear also in the 4th century. I mean, a lot happens in the 4th century, giving an enormous amount of credence to Mary Magdalene. It does disappear. Jesus says, Mary, please say something. You are she whose understanding is greater than all of your brothers. So this is at the same time that the canon is being developed. So we mustn't lose sight of the diversity of the 4th century. So you're talking about rival traditions, and the ones that spoke of Mary as a significant disciple are the ones that are excluded from canonical tradition. That's the difficulty. But of course, the canon doesn't shut down everything. Some people write, yes, and then the canon shuts it down. But in fact, when we read non-canonical texts, we are in fact implicitly what is in and out of the 27 books of the New Testament. And that's part of the interest in Mary Magdalene today.
Indeed,
yes.
Let's talk about the origin of the association of Mary Magdalene as a prostitute. Is there any historical evidence for that? Where did that come from? It's a very charged image that also has endured.
The evidence from the sources as we know is that there's nothing in the New Testament that identifies her as a prostitute. That it's only later, centuries later, that some people within church tradition associates Mary Magdalene with the story of a prostitute who repents and wipes Jesus' feet with her hair. And that association is almost automatic for many people who grow up in Christian tradition, but it's simply not there in the New Testament.
And also the fact that the woman who meets with her sweet and dries with her hair is designated as a prostitute. She's designated as a sinner, which meant they didn't have the same uses of the word for a prostitute in the Greek. It's just not within the law. She alienated herself from God at all. It was not a sexual sin.
Well, there are many men sinners in the Gospels identified by the designation or by the narrator. We would want to jump to another conclusion about what the definition of sin meant in the case of a man. Why is it done in the case of a woman?
Well, in fact, it's the same thing as when Mary Magdalene has her seven devils pulled from her. If a man has seven devils or is a demoniac, he's just unbalanced, mentally sick. But because has only Mary Magdalene has her seven devils driven from her, she has every one of the seven vices driven from her as her pregnant son.
She also seems to be this figure that has, shall we say, a very varied job description within the life of the early churches. A witness to the resurrection, which has the power to save a woman redeemed of a shameful past. Quite extraordinary that one particular figure can embody these various personas and hold all of these meanings. How do you understand how she has been able to hold and carry and inspire all of this?
There are only two figures in the New Testament who are said to have seen Jesus after, by themselves after the resurrection. One is Peter and one is Mary. Now, had she been a man, it would have been assumed that she would be a disciple or an apostle, one of his representatives, and that would have qualified her. But then I think we find a lot in the New Testament that attempts to disqualify her and make sure that that even though she saw Jesus and was one of those enormously privileged, she and Peter alone, she's not a disciple. It doesn't count. She's a woman. She can't testify in court in Jewish law at the time. And therefore, she has to go to the brothers, and they have the brothers, that is the disciples, and they authorize whether Jesus is actually risen, because her testimony is regarded as insignificant.
Well, she doesn't even have an account of her resurrection,
which is so interesting.
Now, you have the mention of it, but you have no narrative of it. Except that John, which is, since I've seen the book called for her, but for years, but I don't want to speak to her one-on-one. Of course, I suppose these should be asked in testimony. The question testimony, the question is testimony. In the way you would question
testimony.
actually seen the Lord resurrect. She actually hadn't witnessed it. Therefore, she could only tell the disciples what she had seen or heard. She hadn't actually seen him rise from the dead, and therefore this prevented her from being an apostle or a disciple, and also hearing Jesus when he was there's still some fancy footwork going on. Related to the question of Mary Magdalene's testimony of the resurrection, in some ways, the scope of the importance of her witness is still called into question. In other words, she was given a commission that was very local in scope. She was only told to tell the disciples of the resurrection. And so, in some ways, this is used to minimize, you know, her role as a witness, whereas she wasn't directly told, go tell everyone. It was just the disciples, so it gives it kind of a secretarial connotation as far as some people are concerned, where, you know, I think if we put a man in that role, if a man had been the first witness of the resurrection and had gone to tell the disciples, he would be probably held up as the primary apostle. And so I think the fact that she's female is still being called into question.
Well, also in our history, the scene in Job 20 with its erotic element, the erotic element's almost overpower the idea that this is you know, to the resurrected Jesus.
Think about that.
Well, I'm interested in, I mean, one time Bible Review did a thing, and, you know, and then I started noticing that the Magdalene is usually lower, you know, and the really Jesus is standing up, and somebody she's actually reaching toward his groin, you know, and so there's all that, you know, and then there's all that stuff about, well, she's, you know, she only wanted to hang on to the body, and she's, you know, and that's a, I think, a very serious misreading visually of the thing. Not that there are erotic elements, but it's reduced to those erotic elements. Oh, yeah, maybe, yeah, right. Sure.
But, you know, that many people have claimed that this suggests that Mary was some kind of witness and apostle. And I actually think John's making the opposite point. That, you know, yes, he says, of course, we know Mary Magdalene was the first to see Jesus. You know, and he describes the scene, but he says, Jesus says, don't touch me, I haven't yet ascended to my Father. Now you know that he hasn't received power. So in Matthew, you know, he dies, he ascends to heaven, he receives power to kind of the message, and then he comes down and says, all power on heaven and earth has been given to me, and I give it to you.
Yeah.
But in John, you know, the author of John makes it totally clear that when Mary sees him, he has no power yet to give her. And the next scene is one in which he appears to the disciples and says, receive the Holy Spirit, and he breathes in, says, you are my apostle. But Mary, as I read it, is not the ointment. She preaches. She goes to Rome before Paul and Peter.
she does all of these things? And do we have women having certain kinds of positions in Orthodoxy? Do we have women having a voice in Orthodoxy? Do we have, I mean, if that's not, she played, yeah, yes. Or if she was a trailblazer, nobody followed.
No, yes, right.
So part of my issue is that trying to retrieve whoever this is from Western traditions and say this will make you as a voice is not necessarily what has proved to be historically available. I know. Among other wonderful things.
Even though the Vatican says that, going back to the Dylan Maitonger, Pope John Paul II, I think in the late 90s, actually gave one of his Wednesday addresses on the Virgin Mary as the first witness of the resurrection. And thinking about that kind of idea could actually provide a lot of illumination on conflation issues, both in the Eastern Church and in the Western, where, you know, Mary of Bethany and Mary Magdalene became one person. And in the Eastern Church, where the Virgin Mary and Mary Magdalene kind of had some conflation going on as well.
In a non-canonical text, we do have those rather provocative statements about how Mary received kisses on the mouth from Christ. How are we to understand that?
There are different ways to understand that. I mean, that's this is all the mouth. The text is all there.
There's a whole statement to
it.
The text of the Gospel of Philip, actually, this is, of course, set off, you know, a lot of picture treatments. The companion of the Lord was Mary Magdalene, and he loved her more than the other apostles. He kissed her often on her, and then the text breaks. And people have filled in mouth because the Coptic word puts it into that blank. But we don't know. And in fact, further on in the text, I mean, it seems to be less sexually sensational and much more the kind of mystical language you find in Jewish tradition, Buddhist tradition, using sexual imagery. Speaks of the kiss as the way that those who are initiated Christians conceive and give birth. And this, I believe, is the so-called kiss of peace. It happens after you receive baptism in the Eucharist. People kiss each other, and they give birth to new Christians this way. So this is a transformation of a sexual procreative act into a spiritual procreative act that happens in baptism. The erotic is freedom, the use of the metaphor. That's right.
As the Son of God, you know, you should be more the yoke of your heart, because you live with Christ, so to speak. But there, you know, the sexual imagery is used, and it's understood to be manifest in spiritual connection. And of course, all of these images, like Mary Magdalene, have so many clusters of associations. You know, they're not one on the word, but clusters of associations. That's why she's so powerfully present in the imaginations of people who connect.
What do the Gospels of the New Testament tell us about Mary Magdalene? How does she appear in those texts?
Well, the Gospel of Mark, which ends, the original Mark ends in 16:8, and then there's other endings that have been tacked on over the centuries. She doesn't get a mission. And she flees from the tomb, and she and the other women flee from the tomb and say nothing to anyone because they're afraid. And it's really interesting because some of the Gospels shows Mark and John and Matthew, she said, go tell. And she's told to go tell. And in Luke, she's not told to go tell, but when she does tell, or when they do tell, their words are regarded as bringing phantom, you know, like in a paper.
She calls us the whole gospel according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So there's one gospel according to the titles of those texts. And there are four different versions of it. Once people have decided that diversity is enshrined in the principle of gospel, then even as the canon limits the gospels to four, you can say that outside the canon, from a historical point of view, we have many more than four gospels. The Gospel of Mary is one of those gospels outside the canon. The Gospel of Philip would be another one. Once you take all the material into account from a historical point of view, then you have a range beyond the four gospels of the New Testament. That is so exciting. Well, it's a completely different perspective of the human intimacy, that the four gospels are a small sample. of a much wider range of early Christian sources that describe, in many of those, Mary appears not as a very minor character, but as in fact quite a major disciple and an important follower of Jesus, one of his most beloved. And so we now have new information that's transformed when we see these early sources. The canonical gospels themselves, I think a lot of people that give authority to it, to them, don't really read them carefully. And they're accustomed to thinking of, conflating and merging them together, and thinking it's all one big story that fits together in a logical fashion, and it doesn't.
There's a story in the New Testament gospels that gets mixed up with Mary. I know this is how we come to understand her as a prostitute. Can you explain that? This is the story that now is located in John's Gospel, around chapter 7. It's a story about a woman. She's the subject. At the end of the story, Jesus says he forgives whatever she's allegedly done. He says, whoever is without sin, that one cast the first stone. He himself does not cast the first stone at all, which is an interpretation of the passage from the body of Jesus. Now, that passage has been connected in tradition with Mary Magdalene. How has it been connected? We don't know how it's been connected. That has been connected, it's quite clear from the history of interpretation. And the association is with Mary Magdalene through the assumption that the one sinner of Luke 7 is connected to perhaps a prostitute, and then the prostitute is understood to connect to a woman taken in adultery. This is a great leap from sin to prostitution to adultery. Why should we connect to Mary Magdalene? It's possible that if Mary Magdalene is traveling circle of Jesus' followers as a single woman, she would have been assumed to be by some possible letters. I don't have any gospel thing where people express horror at the fact that men and women are traveling together. That's easy. I don't think it's that big of a leap. A prostitute is a simple woman, adulteress, it's
Susan, you talked about pious pornography in relation to Mary Magdalene. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
It's basically the images that you get in Mary Magdalene about the 16th century onwards, and that's because at that point she is painted or sculpted as a naked woman due to the legend that she went to South France, went into the capital, and she divested herself of her clothes, and her hair grew down to cover her. And she prayed and she fasted, every day the angels came down to grant her the hair that they knew. The image through the Renaissance became more her nudity rather than anything else, and some of these images are very explicitly pornographic images of a woman. She is flesh personified,
Feminist scholars have done so much work over the last 20 to 30 years to search for, to look for in texts, in visual evidence of what's come to be called the views of the past. I'm listening to this about the pious pornography. Is Mary Magdalene good for women?
Well, I think of her as a propaganda weapon against women, in fact, particularly these images of a repentant so-called prostitute, that she has to, in order to become a holy woman, she has to give away her sexuality. Disciples, and so it's a very difficult to understand.
some circumstances. For example, with, you know, women who, you know, feel that they've been victimized or living in healthy lives, and a lot of rescue organizations are still organized under Mary Magdalene's patronage. And it's interesting that this is clinging, right? It's 1,400 years of tradition, and the Catholic Church changing her designation on a calendar isn't going to turn 1,400 years of tradition on a dime. And it's really with us, whether we want it to be or not. And in some cases, I think it can be healthy, because some people still have this notion that they're trying to live up to the standard that the Virgin Mary has been set up as, and no one can really live up to that standard.
That's significant, because I remember when a student came to me once and said she suddenly realized it was our life's ambition to be virginal. This was the model woman. Right. You have two sexual roles and no sex.
Right.
So Mary expresses, you know, different kinds of resonance,
right,
whether it's freedom to speak or more sexual.
Right.
The perfect activity would be a little more possible.
It's interesting, though, because even though the prostitute identity is a fiction and it's being acknowledged today that there's no scriptural basis for it, if we take that away from people, right, this really potent tradition about Mary Magdalene, are we kind of taking away this woman that some people would be able to identify with in valuable ways otherwise?
It's the question of how sexuality plays in Christian traditions.
Exactly.
It's such a deeper issue.
How it's been ruled out.
Right.
Right.
Except in the kind of salacious around the fruit and stuff.
And I think that's why she is adored. Because that is such a highly charged issue.
Well, it's interesting to me that in some of these other texts, like the Gospel of Philip, you see sexual language being used as a language of spiritual union and mystical exploration. But in the churches, it's very often, you know, there's virginity and then there's sexuality, and there's still such opposite roles.
But back to John 20, you have the Song of Songs clearly as another text there. You know, the scene of Mary Magdalene in the garden and the weeping, and basically the underlying thing, love is strongest.
So it's very central.
Yeah.
And the Song of Songs, there's the special line on it, yes.
And very romantic. And we have these songs is the ancient interpretation, ancient optimism, because in texts like the Bible, the Bible, the biblical Bible for all people, that was essentially the Roman Road Cuts. You find examples of it that's still obtained today, when the image in the Bible is something visual and not textual. It's learned from the Song of Songs that is the Mary Magdalene figure of John 20. The lover looking for the beloved. So this interesting eroticism of the search, not even repenting of the sin, is very much a part of the tradition long before we think about gender.
It's interesting for this, the Song of Songs, which is of course an ancient wedding song that celebrates sexual love, becomes the language of mystical writers like John of the Cross. It's also very interesting how the Song of Songs is also Mary Magdalene's connection to the Bride of Christ. So this is read as early as the 3rd century.
Yes.
Hippolytus identified her with the woman in Song of Songs and as the bride of the bridegroom, placing her in this symbolic position of representing the church collectively in their relationship with Jesus, as well as the individual Christian. That's being revived.
Yes, that's right. In the Gospel of Philip, she becomes Mary Magdalene, becomes a manifestation of the Holy Spirit. And also, the church is Christ's bride.
That is our image of Magdalene. States of undress, either total or partial nudity, because whether she's reading, whether she's in the garden, whether she's on laying across a rock, whatever. Because I think that we have to look at the context of the time periods in which they're made. And we have to look at the concepts of the various forms of love and spirituality that are being evoked at those times. Many times we need to look at them and say, what's going on at that time? What are we thinking about? How's it being
Mary Magdalene, but what are we thinking about the body? What are we thinking about humanity? What are we thinking about sexuality? What are we thinking about what is the basis of Christianity? Is the incarnation, is it not the fleshing of the spirit? It's not simply the denial of the flesh, but it's the flesh has a role.
But it's what are we thinking about the filial love?
Right. Oh, yes,
actually, it's what are men thinking about the filial love?
Well, that's a church.
Yes.
Yes. So what role did Mary's, Mary Magdalene's body play then a different
life? Starts being undressed.
It's at the same time that Jerome is undressed.
When is that?
That's perhaps 15, 14, 15. And it's, they're parallels. You have the two of them in place. Very interesting. Because, you know, it's really, if you look at the history of the Iconian Jerome, and you look at the history of the Iconian Magdalene, at certain moments, they're parallels. And there's certain attributes. So when you have Jerome reading in the wilderness, which is not a Bible, okay, he's dressed. And the first images of the Magdalene reading in the wilderness, she's dressed. And then he's arrested slowly and starts taking her clothes off. Okay? That's that all the rest is exposed. And Jerome, in his breath, has part of his chest exposed. And then when you see Jerome having full... Now, that doesn't mean that Jerome isn't there for all the women in the church to meet.
I'm not saying full for all women.
No, I'm just saying there's a parallel to watching them slowly undressed. And then eventually Jerome gets them to a point for
them.
No, they never get together. No, 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 no,
no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no,
But
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's the truth.
The thing is, the
international
thing of being in the desert,
this is the reading is involved here.
Right, and that's there's this devotion, period of devotion, the Dharma, and the atmosphere, the brotherhood, the common life. And it all connects in with this understanding of also allowing women the right to read in those groups, as opposed to the larger church groups that are going on. So the Magdalene reading, whether she's in the side, or whether she's outside, whatever her state of dress, in those early ones, has a very different meaning than it does when you get into the 18th and 19th century representations of her, which are no doubt more connected to showing the female nude than they are to showing some kind of spiritual reality.
But I'm also hearing you say that even with the range of all these different visual images that we have of her over time, that they're still given to us by men.
Yes, but you have also, you have to look in the context, 16th century paintings were being done in a period when the female body was an ideal body, was an ideal beauty. Mary Magdalene would be described as an ideal beauty. She was a Venus, also in sackcloth, which is the way one art historian described her. And so while she had the image of the ideal woman, she had this other person put on her by the church. Also, we have to think that nudity or nakedness represented truth, and the new body, by the fact that it has not been the case of Mary Magdalene, she had converted to Christ, she was newborn, she was naked. But it's the overtones of the patrons who wanted those paintings were mostly men, which made her come this propaganda against her in the sense she was pin up in a certain sense. She used that sort of rather cheap language, but I mean she was pin up for some patrons. And it was very interesting that Titian painted one of the first of his naked Mary Magdalene's, thinking it was for a man. And it wasn't, it was commissioned by a man from a very pious woman called Victoria Colonna. And she received one of the first naked Mary Magdalene's. She probably had a draped Mary Magdalene in addition to that, but he was painting it for a woman patron.
Is there any evidence of how she liked her
I don't think there's any evidence of how she liked her gift, but she had another painting done at the Nenemi Tantra. Because she was very partial to Mary Magdalene. She found Mary Magdalene a very powerful figure. She wrote to her in one of her a letter to her cousin that Mary Magdalene was the apostle for her. That she was the person who was the first
Lutheran Church or Mary Magdalene, which is a Russian church. And there she's a very much revered saint.
I follow that tradition of nature and the legend, right? But isn't it where she's presented to the emperor, just meaning or something, and he questions something about resurrection, how is that possible? And she's got an egg and the egg transgram or something.
She goes to Rome before Peter.
Yeah.
Well, I think she goes that observation. Yeah. She goes to Rome before Peter. Yeah. And she goes before the emperor. Yeah. And she says to the emperor, like, Jesus is my Lord, kind of statement. Jesus is my Lord, is risen from the dead. And he said, how is that possible? Explain that to me. And she said, just as the egg turns red. And the egg turns red, and that's why in the Eastern Christian traditions, all Easter eggs are to be red, because it's signifying martyrdom, blood of Christ, and the resurrection as preached for the first time in Rome.
I'm interested to know who is Mary for men.
From talking to people, I know that there are a number of men who are interested in Mary Magdalene for various reasons, including they want to make sure that Christianity has the story right? And so there's some kind of visual plot of conflict with how we see Mary Magdalene, and that's probably well, there's the recognition of Mary Magdalene as the apostle that many people are interested in, as well as the current idea that she's kind of a feminine face of the divine. And men are interested in this just as well as women. I mean, the popular concept is that this was only something for women. But, I mean, historically, the idea of feminine divine is something that's been popular for men and women in various cultures at various times. It's not been common in the Christian West until recently. It's really gaining momentum. So men are interested in that as well. And as far as Mary Magdalene's place in other religions, I've heard from Muslims who are interested in Mary Magdalene, and of course the Virgin Mary is mentioned in the Quran, and so, you know, insofar as the Marys collectively are concerned, there's some interest there. And I've heard from Hindus. Of course, the Hindus have goddesses in their belief system, so insofar as Mary Magdalene is now representing the feminine body, I've talked to Hindus who are interested in that idea as well. So, this is to say nothing of the more New Age beliefs or kind of, non-Christian. Well, there's this kind of view of Mary Magdalene that she could have been married to Jesus, and this is highly speculative, but it's a deeply, deeply moving idea for a great number of people, and there's some kind of resonance with this idea.
Do you have any historical evidence for that?
Jesus came married to Mary. Well, the Gospel of Philip has the saying that Mary was the companion of Jesus, and the word koinonos means companion, spouse,
lover.
Right. I mean, but one of the things you find, and that really expands on exactly what you said, is that in, say, mystical Jewish teaching, you find a manifestation of God in masculine and feminine forms, and in many of these alternate forms of Christianity that were excluded from the Orthodox tradition, you see God described as father, mother, and in masculine and feminine ways, because as a feminine articulated in Kabbalah, and it's much of, I've often wondered whether it's mystical Jewish tradition that becomes called heretical among early Christians, because many of those traditions which are really close to Jewish mystical thought are those which become sensible.
I found it very interesting too, since you mentioned Kabbalah, that there was a Christian version of the Kabbalah in the Middle Ages as well. So there definitely was a lot of crossover with mystical Judaism and mystical Christianity. And it, kind of stewed in this powerful mix of the Middle Ages. And there definitely was this sense of the feminine divine in the form of the Shekinah, right? Or, originally was kind of like
the presence of God. And she was personified as a female figure as a Sabbath bride in the Middle Ages. And so, right. And so Mary Magdalene today has, actually the whole concept of Mary Magdalene as the bride of Jesus today has a remarkable similarity to what occurred in the Middle Ages with the idea of the Shekinah as the bride of God.
But back to your question about whether men are interested in Dan was a man.
Are very ancient arguments. Some of them, this is all in the New Age, and I think, well,